This week on The Right Side, the Alberta NDP sets aside $1.4 billion of taxpayer money for industry to reduce emissions. We cover Diane Watts in the BC Liberal leadership race, free trade and Trudeau's failed trip to China, as well as callous remarks from the Minister of Disabilities. This is The Right Side, episode 46, recorded Saturday, December 9th, 2017. Race to the finish. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. Patrick and myself are here, as we are each and every week. Welcome back.
It's good to be here to talk about all of the latest news that's been going on this week.
Yeah, it's certainly been an interesting week. We had a couple of surprises Canada-wise sprung on people at the end of last week, and we're seeing the outcome of those now, but we'll get to that in just a wee bit. We do have a full docket of news this week, so we're going to get right onto that. This is, of course, The Right Side, and if you're wondering what The Right Side is, it's a podcast where we attempt to cut through the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media and provide the other side of the story, or talk about why a certain story is being covered in the wrong way or just not being covered at all. So that's what we're going to do this week, and we're going to start off in Alberta. But before we begin, if you guys want to follow along, our full show notes are available at rightsidenews.ca. So, this week in Alberta, the headline reads as follows: Alberta sets aside $1.4 billion for the industry to reduce carbon emissions. And now, as you might recall, we talked last week about Alberta's carbon tax and how that is set to double on a per ton basis come January 1st, 2018, as well as the amount that we pay on various things like fuel, natural gas, and the like. And everything we talked about is that everything in Alberta, everything that basically moves to get groceries to the grocery store and whatnot, and get all pretty much anything that you purchase from a store gets to that final store by truck, I think. They just don't magically appear on shelves. So that's going to affect everything when it comes to carbon pricing, when it comes to diesel fuel and gasoline. So carbon taxes are going to go up in Alberta come January 1st, 2018. Now, you know, this has a huge negative impact on investment to Alberta, as we've talked about before on The Right Side. But just as a bit of a recap, basically, every industry that comes into Alberta, whether it be involved in the oil industry or if it's some trucking agency or even the CP Rail lines that run, they need to pay extra on the diesel that fuels their trains or their mining operations to remove the oil from the ground with the new carbon levies that are in place by the Alberta government. And as a result of that, they factor that extra price in, that extra cost in, to their bottom line when they're determining if some of these projects that they're going to be looking at should go ahead in the future. And that is what we refer to as long-term capital investment, in that if the project becomes too expensive, well, they're not likely to invest. So, you know, you might hear that the carbon tax is a way that is to improve the environment at the end of the day. Well, it improves the environment at the end of the day by cooling off investment related to things that are not carbon neutral or carbon positive. So this week it was announced that along with this increase to the carbon tax, the government will set aside $1.4 billion for industry to reduce their emissions. Now, for anyone who pays attention to how government works, anytime a government sets aside a set amount of money for whether it be our tax relief or subsidizing a specific industry, or in this case, encouraging businesses and industry to reduce their emissions, that $1.4 billion comes from the taxpayers at the end of the day. And that's where our carbon tax prices are going. Now, Environment Minister this week in Alberta said that this is the, quote, business case for action on climate change, and it has never been more clear, more urgent, or provided so many opportunities. Of course, these opportunities here come from the fact that if businesses don't go green, they will ultimately pay the price in terms of the carbon tax. Now, it's also worth noting that large businesses specifically related to the oil sands industry don't have to pay any carbon tax until 2023. So that's kind of why they signed on and went along with the carbon tax when it was first announced, because they had, I believe at that point, it would be around 7 years of relatively carbon tax-free period. So of this $1.4 billion set aside by the government, $440 million of it is going to the oil industry. $225 million is going to be set aside for carbon reduction innovation. $80 million is going to be set aside for the agency known as Emissions Reduction Alberta. $240 million will be set aside for industrial energy efficiency. And $145 million for the Climate Change Innovation and Technology Framework. And that just highlights some of where this money goes. Now,
and that's a lot of money that's going to places that you wouldn't think would need the money from government.
Exactly.
Right.
And, you know, it comes down to what is, in effect, a case of corporate welfare here. Because rather than, you know, this goes completely counter to what the NDP has stood for going back to its foundings in the 1930s. The founding principles of the NDP in the 1930s and throughout the 20th century was that they were for the people. They were for the working people. But in this case, we can quite clearly see that this is simply a wealth transfer from the working people of Alberta to the rich oil industry companies out there. And businesses have no choice to get in line with this because, you know, the taxpayers are funding this green shift. And by shifting the money to the corporations that would ordinarily oppose such a tax, that is why we have not heard industry speak out against the carbon tax. It's because this is ultimately a tax on the people of Alberta to shift that money to the corporate side in Alberta, which, you know, that sounds an awful lot like something the former Progressive Conservatives would do here.
So, yeah, they're basically buying the corporation's silence in return
until
for taxpayer
2023.
Money.
Until 2023.
That's a lot of money to buy their silence.
Exactly. $1.4 billion. Now, the government wants everyone to believe that this is going to be a new normal and this is going to green the economy. Well, it's going to green the economy by forcing these businesses out of the province without necessarily bringing in new businesses to fulfill their places. And we talked about this before. You can't just flip a switch and expect everyone involved in oil and gas extraction to go and become specialized in solar energy or wind energy. It doesn't work that way. And not to mention that those are still very technologically advanced fields and very expensive with that. So it's not something that can just be turned around in an instant. And that's what the government would like everyone to believe, but it's not the case. And, you know, the government outright knows what the consequences of the carbon tax will be, and they're hiding it. An internal report that was leaked to the Financial Post shows that the carbon tax will cost industry $1.2 billion a year by 2020. And if you'll note the $1.4 billion that's been set aside compared to the $1.2 billion, that's almost completely offsetting it there, except there's a $600 million amount that's missing. So it's a little bit interesting. Now, with that being said, the NDP isn't forecasting any job losses, but with that much money disappearing, everyone just needs to take a moment and wonder how businesses will expand or hire more people under such a regime in this case. The NDP believes what it's selling, and it sums it up by saying, we're not only expecting the oil and gas industry to remain resilient and a driver of our economy, we're also expecting that this kind of regulatory push, along with the innovation fund pool, will in fact have a positive economic effect. And you just need to look into basic principles of economics and think of, okay, let's go back to economics 101 and see when was the last time a tax that was then turned around by the government had a positive economic effect. It doesn't happen. The media ultimately reports numbers on what's happening with the funds to industry from the carbon tax, but they don't talk about the sheer impact of the actual policies that are going to start coming into play in the next number of years, and specifically the amount of money and the amount of investment that something that is held up by many people as an innocuous tax on the people of Alberta is playing such a negative role on Alberta's industry.
Yeah, and something that's also not really talked about very much is you look at all the jobs and all the businesses that are out there. They're right now we're all in the push for Christmas, right? And a lot of retail stores will be doing a lot more business in the month of December. And then as soon as the tax comes in on January 1st, that's after Christmas, right? So that's when,
yeah,
that's generally when the slow periods are for a lot of,
yep,
these retail stores. So they're already going to be hurting for sales to begin with. And then you hit them with another tax that's going to raise up the prices on all of their distribution, all of their transportation, shipping costs. That's going to affect a lot of businesses, and it's probably going to push them over the line when it comes to say hiring new employees or giving raises or benefits,
oh, yeah,
packages,
yeah, definitely,
or things like that.
It's going to be
have quite a big impact.
It's going to be the real determining factor, especially in lots of cases for small businesses that rely on getting their sources from wholesale areas that they don't necessarily deal in the same volume as, say, a McDonald's might, a small business. So that actually hurts them a lot in this case. And I think the most deplorable thing about this is that there's this much money flowing from the government to industry over this when it's regular Albertans who are the ones paying the tax and are feeling it on their heating bills and their gas bills and their power bills and everything. So that is the point that was sorely missed by the mainstream media this week. All right. What do you got for us in BC?
Yeah, so with all the other news stories going on in BC lately, electoral reform that we talked about last week, energy projects such as the pipelines and the Site C Dam, which continually go on, and all the other scandals that are going on, we haven't really had that much time to discuss the BC Liberal leadership race that concludes on February 4th, which is just under 2 months away. And so just to recap how we got here, in case you weren't following BC politics before this, after then Premier Christy Clark's flip-flop on the throne speech after the election in May, where she won a plurality but not a majority, her government was then taken down on a vote of non-confidence by the NDP and the Green parties, with the Greens promising to support the NDP in government in a power-sharing agreement to create a, quote, strong, stable minority government, in Green leader Andrew Weaver's words. Christy Clark promised she'd stay on as opposition leader, but then just a few weeks later resigned both as leader and as an MLA, leaving her Kelowna seat vacant. And with Darrell Plakis jumping the BC Liberal ship to become the speaker, it left the Liberals in no position to challenge for government, and they're basically having to do a hard reset on how they do things. So we fast forward now to today, and the BC Liberals are in the midst of a very unpublicized leadership election. There are currently six candidates in the election, five of whom are males and former cabinet ministers under Christy Clark. And the lone woman in the race is former White Rock Surrey Conservative MP Diane Watts, who is also a former popular mayor of Surrey, which we've talked about on the show before. She resigned her seat in the House of Commons in order to run for the BC Liberal leadership in a similar way that Jason Kenney did in Alberta in order to get the province back on track. Now, Diane Watts hasn't had it easy, though. In every debate, she's gotten hammered for her lack of support in the caucus, which is kind of understandable as she's an outsider in the race. And people are concerned that Watts won't be able to hold together the BC Liberal informal coalition of traditional free enterprise Liberals and Conservatives that is designed as a way to keep the NDP out of power. And as she's more of a Conservative than previous Liberal leaders Wilson, Campbell, and Clark, this means that some are worried that some of the more center-leaning people in the party will end up leaving for the NDP if she wins. Now, she's also been widely criticized in the media for not having a proper platform, which is something that Conservative leader Andrew Scheer was notably lacking in his candidacy as well.
They've criticized Watts, Jason Kenney, for that here, too.
Indeed. And Watts counters this by saying that she spent the last 2 months traveling around the province, listening to voters, a move that she adds the party failed to do ahead of the spring election. She says, quote, "We lost the election because you guys stopped listening. If we've ever got a hope to get back into government, we need to make sure we are re-engaging and rebuilding the trust that was lost." However, her performance in the debates has been rather flat, as she's not been able to offer any platform-specific plans as a response to questions. Now, she's also raised the ire of the other leadership candidates because of her criticism in the party and its loss of so many seats and eventually the government in the past election, which is criticism that her rivals likely find fairly irritating since they were members of that government. And now the Liberal leadership will be decided similar to how the federal Conservative race was. Under the rules of the leadership race, all 87 ridings are treated equally and are each assigned 100 points. The points are then allocated to each candidate based on the percentage of votes that they get from the members in each riding. For example, if a candidate gets 42% of the vote in a riding, he or she will get 42 points. And then a preferential ballot will also be used where party members can make second, third, or more choices. And then if no one wins on the first ballot, the second choices are then redistributed, and that process continues until a candidate receives the majority of the points. So for those who are following the federal Conservative race, that's exactly how they held it there, just across Canada with the 338 ridings. And, of course, what happens in this race will really be dependent on how each of the candidates are covered in the media. And currently, it seems that Watts is actually garnering the most attention, which you would probably expect, being the party outsider, as well as the only female in the race. But a lot of that coverage has been very slanted against her. Watts is currently leading in the polls, but as we all know how trustworthy those are. Now, if she is to win, it will be because she's able to reach a lot of the Liberal supporters that felt disillusioned from the party in the last election, as well as signing up new members from the Conservative wing of the province, of which there are large amounts outside of the Lower Mainland and Vancouver Island. One thing's for sure, it's going to be a very tough race to predict, and we'll have further coverage on that in the lead up to the final count as we move through December and into January.
You know, I have to commend them for pulling this race together relatively quickly. I think you said it ends on February 4th.
Yes, that is the case.
Yeah, February 4th. That's pretty quick in the grand scheme of things. It's not a year-long race, and I can see why they would want to do that in a minority government scenario. So, you know, I think one other interesting thing that should be looked at in regards to these candidates, and specifically Diane Watts, is a question of do any of them have the persuasion skills mid-race and perhaps in between election to potentially work with the Green Party, because, you know, there is always the possibility that the Green NDP deal could come apart. So that should also be something that these candidates are asked for. And I don't think anyone in the mainstream media would think to ask such a question at this point in the race.
No, and that's very true. And one would think that as a former Conservative, Diane Watts would probably be most diametrically opposed to the Green Party platform, and that maybe a more centrist candidate would be able to do that. However, the centrist candidates are the ones that were in the former Clark government that would have been able to try and work with the Green Party, and they failed to do so. So maybe having an outsider to the party would actually be a good thing for them on that front. And that's something that, as you said, hasn't really been talked about very much in the sense of how these BC Liberals can get back into power or what their path would be. And that's something that a lot of them don't really talk about. I think a lot of the coverage and the articles in the media kind of takes the BC NDP government for granted, yeah, saying that they're going to be, yeah, there. They're almost reaffirming that phrase that it's a strong, stable minority government, because they don't realize that in politics, things can happen very quickly.
Yeah, and minority governments very rarely last longer than 18 months.
Yeah.
And even these confidence and supply agreements like the Greens and the Liberal or NDP have.
Yeah, and we've covered quite a few stories on the right side where there's been a lot of times where the Greens and the NDP don't agree on something. It's just that we haven't reached the breaking point yet where the Greens are not going to support the NDP. So we'll have to see how this plays out in the future for sure, and how a new leader for the BC Liberals will change politics in BC.
Alrighty then, ready to take the trip to China this week?
I think we're all ready to take the trip to China. It's just whether Trudeau was ready to take the trip to China, yes?
Right. So, you know, you very rarely see in our media here saying, headlines saying, Trudeau failed. Trudeau's failed trip to China. Trudeau fails to commence free trade negotiations with China. Trudeau and failed is not something we have seen a lot of in the media before. And, you know, this is something I think that if it were a different government, it would have been dominating the entire news cycle this weekend. Quite frankly, I'm surprised that it isn't, given the previous week before that we were talking about Bill Morneau and his issues. And you'd think that everyone would want to change the channel from that, but they haven't. But Trudeau actually made a rather impromptu trip to China that was only announced a week and a half ago. And the goal of this trip was to ultimately start up free trade talks with China. And the big surprise out of this is that that ultimately didn't happen. You know, free trade talks, those take a long time to complete and many rounds of negotiations, lots of trust in between both countries involved in this case. And the hope was that the government would go to China and they would be able to have a joint news conference with the Chinese and say that we are now conducting free trade talks for a free trade agreement. But they didn't get that far. And it was actually a pretty icy reception here. The trip was pretty rocky to begin with because representatives from both China and Canada were actually heard arguing first when they got there about the Canadian media's access to the photo op of the two leaders. So there were rumblings that there was a problem with this trip from the very beginning. And to sum up about how big of a letdown this is, former Finance Minister John Manley said that prime ministers usually don't go on trips like that without something to announce. And I mean, that makes sense because you wouldn't take the whole delegation, you wouldn't take the government of Canada plane, you wouldn't spend that much money on a trip if you weren't announcing something of major substance. So agreements were, though, announced regarding agricultural exports, energy exports, and educational ties between the two countries, though, of course, not free trade. A news conference was planned, but instead only prepared statements were read by both Justin Trudeau and the Prime Minister of China. Now, you might be wondering about why this is a big deal, but we'll get to that in just a moment. It ultimately refers to what the internal Communist Party in China thinks of Canada at this point, and it's that Canada is requesting perhaps a bit too much, especially when it comes to China's policy on human rights, but more on that in just a moment. So with this, Trudeau was committed to his reliable triple in terms of trade negotiations of labor rights, gender rights, and climate change, which he has been adamant on in any of the trade deals that he's been talking about, whether it was with the European Union, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the NAFTA renegotiations, and now this potential free trade deal here with China. And, you know, I don't think China was having any of this here because that isn't what China, a developing country, is concerned about. Labor rights and gender rights are not something enshrined in China. And climate change is something China would like to work on, but as a developing country, they need energy and they need to get it as cheaply as they can. And they do that with coal, and that is a form of dirty energy, especially in China. Now, you might be wondering, okay, a free trade deal with China might actually be pretty good, but we need to actually start thinking about whether or not this is actually a good deal here for Canada, because we have a substantial trade deficit with China, and that should be strongly considered in any trade deal that we make. So a trade deficit is just like a deficit in any other budget. Having a trade deficit means that we import more from that country than we export to that country. And that effectively means that the other country is making more money off of us than we are off of them. And the trade deficit between Canada and China for the last full fiscal year of 2016 was close to $45 billion. And it's only expanding and has continued to expand for the last decade and a bit. And this really shows the true double-edged sword of free trade, that yes, we can, you know, get access to the Chinese market for tons of Canadian goods, Canadian energy, Canadian technological ideas and products, Canadian wheat, pretty much anything we make in Canada, we could get access to in that market. But at the same time, when China artificially manipulates their currency value to be competitive on the world stage. They have a $45 billion trade deficit with China. Their wages are artificially lower and much lower than ours in Canada. We also have the problem of China's working conditions compared to those in Canada. And I don't think anyone would disagree that if you compare a factory in Ontario compared to a factory in China, where are you going to find the better working conditions?
Yeah, and that's something that is a lot of concern when you're talking about free trade, is the different disparity between labor conditions
exactly
between the first world country and the developing country.
Yeah, and to give an example of this, Foxconn is a Chinese company and they make chips for iPhones and the like. And when they build and assemble these iPhones, they effectively have work camps set up where people live on campus and they work there, and then they're able to make a good wage doing that. But the amount of pressure that goes into jobs like that is just extreme. It was reported a number of years ago that there are actually suicide nets outside of the Foxconn factories in China to prevent people from jumping to their death to get out of their job. So this is really the double-edged sword of free trade. A $45 billion trade deficit, currency differences, wage differences, working condition differences, so much so that you have cases like Foxconn in China. And, you know, at that point, you have to ask, what would Canada really be getting out of a free trade deal with China, aside from, you know, market access for a few sectors of our economy? But in turn, China gets to import more to us cheaper. It seems like China would be a win in that case. And with that being said, it's kind of interesting to guess as to why the Canadian delegation would have went to China under the assumption that China's objections to Trudeau's triple on trade had been settled, when it clearly wasn't based on what we saw in the meetings this week. And even this week in the National Post, John Iveson said Trudeau emerged to give his final statement looking like he was the boy at Christmas who expected a bike, but instead got a pair of plain socks. And his article was followed by a cartoon of Justin Trudeau getting the boot out of China's Great Hall. And this sentiment was actually further repeated and echoed in the Globe and Mail by Dan Suryak, who is a trade consultant and former deputy chief economist for foreign affairs. He said that the progressive trade agenda is well framed conceptually, but it's a minor part of the big picture. It should not be, at this point in time, a stumbling point for Canada signing trade agreements. I am still mystified at the failure to launch trade negotiations with China. Now, that's how we're seeing things in Canada, but China is seeing things completely different here in the Chinese Communist newspaper, the China Global Times. That newspaper said that when Canada imports a pair of shoes from China, will Canada ask how much democracy and human rights are reflected in those shoes? And if you look at what John Iveson said and what was echoed in the Globe and Mail and how China sees it, that is indeed the stumbling block, this progressive triple that Justin Trudeau insists on when negotiating his free trade agreements. Now, you might think that this is just a stumbling block for free trade with China, but it also affects TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and NAFTA, because you'll recall last month Justin Trudeau actually walked out of a meeting in Australia regarding the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that effectively held up ratification of the deal. And I think the hope with that is that Justin Trudeau was thinking he'd be able to hold on the TPP and kickstart negotiations with China and use that to make his position better with TPP. And now this leads directly into NAFTA, because if he had negotiations going on with China and he got a better deal with TPP, he could use that, I think, is the feeling of the Foreign Affairs Department, to get a better deal with the U.S. in regards to NAFTA. Now, of course, we have none of those three right now. So it's a question of, where does this government go next for free trade, specifically in regards with NAFTA, as the U.S. is our biggest trading partner, and TPP, because that also has potential economic impact. And there's one final note on the story here. You know, there's been a lot regarding trade with the U.S. recently, and specifically the spat between Bombardier and Boeing. You know, Bombardier makes airplanes, and there was a spat trade spat between the U.S. and Canada on their C-Series jet, so much so that it has forced Canada to stop buying Boeing F-18s new from the United States. And instead, we're going to end up buying used F-18s from Australia. So as you can see here, this stumble in China cascades all the way down to TPP, NAFTA, and even our fighter jets that we were supposed to be buying from the U.S., but now we're buying from Australia.
Yeah, and this is something that it seems like the government has wrong. I think that they're trying to play hardball on a lot of issues that other countries really don't care that much about. And we've talked about that before on the show as well, when we were talking about in our first few stories on NAFTA, is that Trudeau's goals for a trade deal do not line up with other countries' goals for trade deals too. And what he's fighting for, it doesn't seem all that important in the grander scheme of things. And it's actually causing him to lose a lot of trade negotiations and to completely fail in other trade negotiations, just because that's what his priorities are on.
Right.
And that's something that the government, I think, should be looking at, just to see if that's really what they want to be fighting for, or if they want to fight for the economy of Canada, which in a trade deal, I think, is much more important.
Yeah. And, you know, personally, I don't feel that it is the right time for a trade deal, a free trade deal with China. I think TPP is okay. I think NAFTA is something we should definitely work to preserve. But if this is going to be a stumbling block that is going to affect everything down the line, then that's a major problem. And I think it was best said in the Globe and Mail that, you know, his triple there shouldn't really be a stumbling block to cause the government of Canada to fail to launch trade negotiations with any country, let alone China.
Yeah, and it all comes down to diplomacy as well, and how Canada is viewed on the world stage. And something that, since Trudeau has been elected, that's something that a lot of people have been saying about him, is that he's really raised Canada's profile on the world stage. Now, he's going around to these different governments, such as the governments that were involved with TPP, and he is walking out of a meeting there. How does that make it look for Canada if our leader is doing something like that?
And
how do we look in China when he goes to China and has all these priorities that China doesn't even want to discuss? Or in how we're still not able to get a deal done on NAFTA? I mean, it's really eroding our Canada's look on the world stage, and that's something that's supposed to be a strength of Trudeau's.
Yeah. NAFTA should have been the easiest trade deal to fix up.
Yeah, and he's still having trouble with it, apparently. So it just goes to show that what he is prioritizing is the wrong move. And that's something that is going to really hurt Canada in the long run if we can't get these trade deals done.
Yep. All right. So you might have thought that was firing line, but what do you got for firing line?
Yeah, so we've got a crazy headline that just came out just this past week, and it's called "Everyone Has a Sob Story. Thalidomide Survivors Say They Were Belittled by Disabilities Minister." So members of a thalidomide survivor group say they felt belittled and are appalled after meeting with Kent Hare, who is the Federal Minister for Persons with Disabilities, and accuse him of making repugnant statements about their life expectancies. For this Canada story, we'll need a bit of background. Thalidomide was developed in the mid-1950s in West Germany as a miracle cure against morning sickness, anxiety, and other ailments. Now, a few years later, it was found that thousands of infants born to mothers who had taken thalidomide were born with phocomelia, which is a disease that causes deformed limbs. Now, only 40% of those infants survived, and a lot of those survivors had to deal with a plethora of terrible and painful disabilities. Now, Canada was one of the last countries to ban the drug in 1962, and since that time, most survivors of thalidomide have received annual benefits as compensation from the Canadian government. Now, Kent Hare, we'll give a bit of background on him as well. He was a former Alberta Liberal who then ran federally as a Liberal in the 2015 election and narrowly and surprisingly won in a riding that had been some variant of Conservative since it was created in the 1960s. And he was one of the first Liberals to be elected in Calgary since 1968. Now, Hare became a quadriplegic in 1992 after getting shot in a drive-by shooting in Calgary. And this past summer, he became Trudeau's Minister of Sport and Persons with Disabilities in a cabinet shuffle. Now, part of Hare's portfolio as that minister includes meeting with groups that advocate for people with disabilities, such as the Thalidomide Survivors Task Group. Now, according to members of that group, Hare belittled them and made appalling comments regarding their disability. Now, the minister flat out denies at least one of their claims and said he has apologized if some of his comments were misinterpreted. So let's talk about what those comments were and what the Thalidomide Survivors Task Group members say that he actually said that was so repugnant. So Fiona Sampson, who is a thalidomide survivor, she's also a human rights lawyer, and she's the chair of the task group. She attended the October 19th meeting with him and told reporters on Tuesday that Hare degraded those in attendance with his remarks. She said, quote, "In response to members of the group reading really heartfelt testimonials, Minister Hare, apropos of nothing, commented, 'Well, you don't have it as bad today as adults as you did when you were kids.' He then went on to say, 'Well, you don't have it so bad. Everyone in Canada has a sob story.'" Now, Sampson said that one of the most repugnant statements in the 30-minute meeting came after the group explained to Hare that they have shortened lifespans and have already lost five members since the House of Commons passed a unanimous motion to support survivors back in 2014. He said to us, quote, "So you probably have about 10 years left then now. That's good news for the Canadian government." She said, "We were shocked and appalled." One of the members in that meeting was hospitalized in the ICU 2 weeks later, and Sampson said that made his comments seem especially repugnant. Now, in a statement after this, Hare denied making comments about lifespans at the meeting, but said that he apologized to the organization after his comments were misconstrued. "My heart goes out to the thalidomide survivors. I have listened to their stories, and I know our government, led by the Minister of Health, is taking the concerns very seriously, and I will continue to advocate on behalf of all Canadians with disabilities. As someone with a disability myself, it was certainly not my intention to offend anyone. While some of my comments were misconstrued, as soon as I learned that my comments were felt to be offensive, I immediately called the organization directly and apologized." Hare was asked about his conduct during question period in the House of Commons on Tuesday and answered by reading a similar statement to the one he sent out earlier to the media. So now the survivors are calling on the federal government to honor pledge to compensate them with a lump sum payment of $250,000 and increased annual pensions. They say that patients have received lump sums of $125,000 each, noting that they're struggling to make ends meet due to the extent of their disabilities. And what's worse is that this is not the first time this week that Harris had to apologize for his behavior. He admitted to sometimes being brash and inappropriate after a fresh complaint of disrespect surfaced on Thursday, this one from a Calgary woman engaged in a class action lawsuit against the federal government. Jennifer McRae, who has been fighting on behalf of a group of mothers who say that they were denied benefits while on maternity leave, contacted Hare's office in October 2016 after being encouraged to speak to local MPs about her case. She said, quote, "He was very condescending." Noting that she was able to secure less than 2 minutes of his time, she asked him pointedly why Ottawa continues to fight sick women, a loaded question to which he allegedly replied, "Well, Miss McRae, that is the old question, like asking, when did you stop beating your wife?" Which, of course, a loaded question is where any answer will incriminate you. If you say, "I stopped beating her," then you are basically admitting to beating her. You know, that's the old police question that they used to ask you in interviews. Now, she said, "I didn't respond with anything because my jaw was on the floor. I was just literally wondering who talks like that, let alone a minister or member of parliament." Now, McRae has said she decided to come forward about Harris' comments after hearing a group of thalidomide survivors describe earlier this week how they felt belittled by Harris' bedside manner during a meeting earlier this year. So now we have no proof either way on what actually happened, as it appears to be a he said, she said sort of story. However, you have to think that the allegations are almost unbelievable that an elected official who lives with a severe disability, such as quadriplegia, would be so callous to others with disabilities as well. And the fact that he didn't offer a proper defense of his comments and only read out prepared statements as an apology is also a bit head-scratching. One would think that someone in his position would be in full damage control. Now, as Chris Selly of the National Post writes, if anything, Harris' written statement, which references misconstrued remarks without enlightening anyone as to their nature, is even worse. Quote, as someone with a disability myself, it was certainly not my intention to offend anyone, it reads. So what on earth does that mean? Was Hare there in his capacity as a quadriplegic or as a minister of the crown? In which capacity would have been less insane to enrage a room full of thalidomide victims with comments that he still refuses to explicitly disavow making? Now, Selly also writes, any halfway normal human being observing this spectacle would conclude that Hare must be completely full of it. If he didn't say these things, why would he not deny saying them? And if he did say these things, why on earth would the Liberal government want to keep him on in such a position?
Well, there's two cabinet ministers now that appear to have major ethical and disciplinary problems on the Liberal side. And, I think it ultimately comes down to it that in a situation like this, you need to realize who is speaking and that there's an expectation that a minister will be professional and hear the complaints that his constituents and people in general are making, especially when you're one like Kent Hare, who himself is a quadriplegic, and his history within Alberta and Calgary should, if anything, make him more humble about this than he actually is. Prior to the last Alberta election in 2015, he was one of three Liberal MLAs here in Alberta. And, after that election, they were wiped out to only one. He could have stayed in Alberta, continued to be an MLA, but he chose to go federal. And I don't know if that was the right choice for him.
Yeah, and now that he's in cabinet, there's going to be a lot more of a spotlight being put on him, and it's just something that it makes you scratch your head as to how someone could treat someone so callously when they've got a disability as well. And speaking as a member of the cabinet, as you said, you'd think that they would act with a little bit more professionalism. And it also makes you think that both of the Calgary Liberal MLA or MPs that got elected in this last election, that was a huge story that happened back on election night, is that the Liberals actually won some ridings in Calgary, which is something that hadn't happened in almost 40 years and, or over 40 years, almost 50 years. And now, the first one, Darshan Singh Kang, who left the Liberal caucus due to sexual harassment allegations, and now Kent Harris under fire. It's probably making a lot of Calgary voters wondering why they voted Liberal in the first place, right?
Yeah.
So this is just something else that came out about this story. I was really surprised myself when I saw it.
And what's really baffling about this is we really haven't heard much about this in the Alberta media. I'm in Edmonton, but normally if something like this were to happen in Calgary, at least federally, we would hear about it. It's a little bit shocking that it hasn't been reported on locally first in Alberta. So
it received some national coverage, especially in places like the CBC and the Globe and Mail and the National Post and Global. But after that initial round, it doesn't seem like there's any follow-up to it whatsoever. It seems like the media has just swept it under the rug again, dealing with other topics. So it's just another story to add to the many stories that we have that talks about Trudeau in a, or Trudeau's government or members of Trudeau's government in a bad light, and they just get swept under the rug again.
Yep, certainly seems like that. Well, we're going to move on to Word of the Week right now, and our Word of the Week this week is free trade, which is defined as international trade based on the unrestricted international exchange of goods without tariffs, quotas, or other restrictions. And, you know, this primarily comes back to the China story, but also in regards to the Americans and Boeing and Bombardier with the F-18s. But if you imagine trade with China without tariffs, quotas, or any other restrictions, given the massive size of the Chinese economy, we need to question, and rightfully question, about whether or not that is right for Canada at this point in time, opening ourselves up to the Chinese economy when we have a $45 billion trade deficit. And that ends our topic list for this episode of The Right Side. If you guys want to find more or find full show notes for this episode, you can find that at rightsidenews.ca. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and YouTube at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes or /YouTube. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at rightsideca. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
And we will be here to give you the news of the week and to make sure that we cut through the bias and sensationalism to make sure that you get to the core of the story. With that, we will see you next week.